From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, we visit an amphitheater built by veterans who are working with the Shakespeare Center of Los Angeles on its production of Henry IV. And we sit down with Tom Hanks, who takes to that stage as Falstaff.
If TV is about the producers who write characters, and film about directors who tell stories, the theater, after opening night and for however long the rest of the run is about actors and their language.
And an investigation into Spotify-curated playlists shows the music industry is becoming increasingly male-dominated. All that coming right up.
KPCC supporters include Freeform's Grownish, produced by ABC Signature Studios, Emmy-eligible for Outstanding Comedy Series, lead actress Yara Shahidi, and contemporary costumes. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
And National Geographic's One Strange Rock, executive produced by Darren Aronofsky and Newtopia and hosted by Will Smith, the Emmy-eligible series takes viewers on a trip around the world. NatGeoTV.com/FYC.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Earlier this week, I put an address into Waze for the Japanese Garden on the sprawling West LA campus of the Veterans Administration. It was not easy to find. The garden is tucked away next to the VA's golf course and baseball field, but it was worth it. This pocket of nature is where the Shakespeare Center of Los Angeles is putting on a summer production of Henry IV, Parts 1 and 2. The cast includes Joe Morton and Hamish Linklater, and playing the outsized Falstaff is Tom Hanks. Sporting a gray beard, the Oscar-winning actor welcomed us to his temporary theatrical home.
This is the Japanese Gardens on the VA, a special little place. We're inside the little kind of like Good Host gazebo. I think they call this the folio area, where you can come and gather and have snacks before. And if you really want to throw down a truly hot cup of coffee down your neck at intermission, you have about 8 minutes to do it.
So you made your professional stage debut in 1977.
Yes.
In productions of The Taming of the Shrew and Hamlet at the Great Lakes Shakespeare Festival in Cleveland, Ohio.
Yes.
For the lucky few who were in attendance then, what would they have seen? Would they have seen a glimpse of the future that lay ahead, or not so much?
I don't know. Well, the Hamlet that we did, I played a part called Reynaldo that is sent to spy on Laertes. And I just had a series of lines that were things like, I will, my lord. I should, my lord. If so, my lord. That was it. It's usually a part that's cut. I don't know why they kept it in.
What do you remember from that period of your life as an actor and about doing repertory in Cleveland? Did you feel that was the calling and that was the life?
We all felt as though we were the luckiest people on the planet. It was a great fervent time because we were busy every single moment of the day. Vincent Dowling, who was the artistic director, he said, I cannot pay you money, but I can give you something much more valuable, which is experience with professionals, which was not only a magnificent con, but it was also the truth. And we were there because it was still in rotating rep, and he needed bodies, literally, to change the sets over every night. So we would work all day, perform, do our duties in the production, and then for about 2 hours until 2 o'clock in the morning, we as a group would goof around and play around and come up with bits as we're changing over the set. So if you asked any of us, we felt we were just the luckiest people in the world that were given an opportunity to do this for no money, but for just for the experience.
Last year in the book Falstaff, Give Me Life, the critic Harold Bloom wrote about why he thought the character that you play is so important. He called Falstaff the true and perfect image of life. He exposes what is counterfeit in me and in all others. And Bloom said that Falstaff is, quote, at his best, a giant image of human freedom.
He lives literally in the moment. He makes things up as he goes along. He sees an opportunity in order to advance himself or get out of a jam, and throws himself wholeheartedly into either whatever is required. Orson Welles has spoken about how he's the most honest character in all of Shakespeare. Quite frankly, I didn't know that much. I knew of Falstaff, but outside of a few pretend references to being familiar with chimes at midnight and always pretending you know all the Shakespeare histories. Oh, yes, Henry IV, part one. Oh, yes, part one is not the complete play that part two. No, is it part two? No, part two is a much more complete play than part one. Other than that, the great discovery that I went through on all of this was to discover that immediacy that he has. Other characters, like, he's out for something. He's out to avenge the death of his father. Richard III is out to become king. Iago is out to square the great injustice of only being an underling to Othello. Falstaff wants to have a good time. He wants to wake up in the morning and figure out, how am I going to maximize a good time today? And he does it throughout the entire play. And he does it in ways that are irrefutably brilliant.
If not borderline. I mean, he is a thief.
He is a rogue.
He is a liar. He
is a thief.
He's a drunk.
He is a liar.
Before I knew you, Hal, I knew nothing. And now I am little better than one of the wicked.
Oh, where shall we take a purse tomorrow, Jack?
Zounds, where thou wilt, lad, I'll take one. And I do not call me a villain and baffle me.
I see a good amendment of life in thee, from praying to purse taking.
Why, Hal, it is my vocation, Hal. It is no sin for a man to labor at his vocation.
When an actor like of your stature does a play like this, you are going to attract people who don't typically go to the theater, don't typically check out Shakespeare. Is that important, that audiences might come into this because of you and discover something along the way?
It's hopefully that's the high country that you land on. I've heard a lot of people say, you know, a lot of times Shakespeare is work and the job or homework. You know, you're supposed to like it, you're supposed to appreciate it. When you can trick an audience into just sitting there and listening and being entertained, you win. When it's no longer this thing that is separated between now and 500 years, and you get used to the cut, you figure out what a leather jerkin is, and you dig the sword fights, and then you start listening to the verbiage that goes on, you realize what everybody's talking about. That's what you're yearning for every time. You always and this is true. There's almost always somebody in the theater who might be seeing that, certainly that play for the first time, or maybe even a play for the first time. And if you can, you know, hit them with that lightning bolt of magic, well, then you've won a convert over to something to an art form that they'll carry with them forever.
After the break, Tom Hanks shares what he gets from theater that he doesn't find in film or TV. And he also talks about how the company came to the VA campus.
KBCC podcasts are supported by Freeform's The Bold Type, produced by Universal Television. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Drama Series, and Freeform's Grown-ish, produced by ABC Signature Studios. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Comedy Series, Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for Yara Shahidi, and Outstanding Contemporary Costumes. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
KPCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's global event series, Genius. The new season stars Antonio Banderas as Spanish painter Pablo Picasso, one of the most influential and celebrated artists of the 20th century. Antonio and Picasso both hail from the same hometown, Malaga, Spain, where the production spent several days filming, including in the same house where Picasso was born. The series is Emmy eligible in all categories. Visit natgeotv.com/FYC for more information. Don't just consider, explore.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. There's some great theater with some big names in L.A. right now. Earlier this week, Leslie Manville was on this show. She's starring opposite Jeremy Irons in a production of Long Day's Journey Into Night at the Wallace in Beverly Hills. And today we're talking with Tom Hanks. He plays Falstaff in a new and dramatically condensed production of Henry IV, Parts 1 and 2. We visited with Hanks outdoors in the Japanese garden of the VA campus, where veterans help build the theater. We'll pick up my conversation with Hanks, reflecting on what he gets from acting on stage.
If TV is about the producers who write characters, and film about directors who tell stories, the theater, after opening night and for however long the rest of the run is about actors in their language. There's no more selfish. There's no more fun you can have than doing this. And what it does for your brain and what it does for your instrument. I never would ever see myself as Falstaff in a movie because, well, how much of a suit and makeup can you kind of take? At the end of the day, you know that it's fake. Here, you know that it's fake, but that's part of the bargain in the first place. You know you're sitting in a Japanese garden, not in a movie theater. You know you're outside instead of being indoors. You know that the acoustics are different. And we begin the show still in daylight, and it's the longest crossfade to darkness that you could ever possibly imagine because it's God's own light under God's own trees.
And how important is it that this play is performed not only on the campus of the VA, but that veterans have built your stage? They've built your scaffolding. They are, as I saw, we were walking in today, folding the blankets that patrons will wrap themselves into. That this is something that is not only on the campus of the veterans, but the veterans have actually helped make the show.
It's another form of that high country that you're looking for. We were backstage with a guy. Guys were in charge of our props, who have learned how to run props for a show, which is a very specific thing to do. And I've talked to guys who'd never even been to the theater before, not much less worked on one. The exposure that we can give to these guys is just, number one, it's just something for them to do. You know, a lot of them just need that. But then they also hopefully can transfer some of the esprit de corps that can come along with the reasons that we're in an acting company for the first place. We had Ray Porter, who plays the Douglas, as well as I think he's got like five roles in this thing. He was explaining to a veteran about the pulsating excitement that will come from as you hear the murmur of the crowd in the stands, and you know there's 10 minutes before places and 5 minutes before. He was littling to describing the excitement of starting of a play to a guy who has been in combat before. So he felt like an absolute idiot for a moment. But the guy that he was talking to said, I get that. And to give them an exposure to this just ends up being magical. The other aspect of it too is that we get to come here and use this, use the trees and the hills and the night and the light. And the caveat is, well, you got to have a lot of veterans involved on it as well. Otherwise, you don't get to. He says, we win. Great. Bring them on. That's only going to add to the experience.
Tom, great to see you.
Good to see you, John. Thanks for coming by.
While we were visiting with Tom Hanks, there were veterans folding blankets that the audience would use later that evening after the sun went down, and some actors were rehearsing a sword fighting scene on stage. This production of Henry IV was the brainchild of Ben Donenberg. He's the founder of the Shakespeare Center of Los Angeles. The company has worked for decades in downtown LA, so I asked him how they ended up on the VA campus in West LA.
This is a very special space, and it is the best place in Los Angeles County for quiet, intimate Shakespeare. I've been in so many venues. I've been in downtown Los Angeles at California Plaza. I've been at Union Station. I've been at Grand Hope Park. I've been in Palos Verdes at the South Coast Botanic Garden. I've been just about anywhere, Burton Chase Park and the Marina. We've been everywhere, and this place is hands down intimate, supportive, beautiful, and you can hear every word. We have 600 people here, and no one is more than 10 rows away. You're like in your living room.
There's certainly war at the center of Henry IV, parts 1 and 2. And while it's a history, and while it's a story about a father and a son, it's also about the cost, perils, and folly of war. Do you think veterans look at a play like this differently than non-veterans? Is there something that they would see in Henry IV that people who haven't been in combat wouldn't take away?
Oh, 100%. That's 100% correct. These guys sit and watch the sword fights, and they listen to the play, and they see the relationships. You know, they watch Hotspur and his wife before he goes off to war, and the difficulty that the wife is having with the husband, who is a soldier. And it's very easy for them to identify with the predicaments and the testosterone that's needed. And then what do you do with that testosterone when there's no place to put it after it's over and all of that kind of stuff?
The Shakespeare Center of LA started in 1986, is that
correct?
Right?
Correct.
With performances in Pershing Square. How has the company evolved since then, and how would you describe its relationship to downtown and to Los Angeles more broadly?
Well, artistically, the company has always had a commitment to great art doing great things. So we've always had this commitment to really create art that contributes tangibly to the social fabric of our community. When we started the company, we used to collect canned food, and Vons companies would match it. And we collected millions of dollars of food that we would give to Salvation Army family feeding programs, some of whom were veterans, as a matter of fact, all those years ago. And I've always linked our art making to community development and human services.
I think it's very funny that Falstaff has just died in a rehearsal behind us. And for people who don't know Henry IV, Part 1, when Falstaff dies, he isn't quite, in the words of the Monty Python song, not dead yet.
Right. Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert.
I'm sorry. Keep going.
So, yeah. So we've been working downtown for 30 years. We actually have our headquarters downtown. We have a 13,000-square-foot facility that a wonderful architect named Zoltan Pali has designed a renovation for us, and we are working on putting together a leadership team to turn that 13,000 square feet into 22 and making that a real company headquarters for the months of the year that we can't be outdoors.
You also put a high priority on developing new audiences within the community and making sure that local kids are involved. Tell us a little bit about those initiatives and why they're important to the company.
Well, right after Rodney King, the city came to us and said, because of our reputation as a community-based arts organization with high-quality art and a commitment to access and audience development, what could we do with kids who were most affected by these riots? And we went into the community. We went to Nickerson Gardens. And we went into East L.A. to Father Greg Boyle's thing. He had a church in East L.A. at that time before he had Homeboy Industries. And we did focus groups with kids. And what they said was what they really wanted were teachers who they felt cared about them and real jobs that were meaningful. And so we went back to the drawing board and worked with our teaching artists to create a job program for kids who live in poverty, at the poverty threshold. And over the last 25 years, we have hired thousands of kids, and their summer job is to study a Shakespeare play with a team of professional artists and rewrite it in their own vernacular and create their own adaptations of Shakespeare's plays. That's called Willpower to Youth. And they design the play, they write the play, they perform the play, and they are transformed by this process of an immersive literacy program that pays them money. Again, just like this program, it's a powerful program that helps young people make a transition to adulthood. So we're using art as a tool for transition, because the five major components of anyone going through a we've done a lot of work on this. The five major components is you need to, when you're going through a transition, it's really helpful to have a mission. It's really important to feel a sense of identity. It's important to have meaning and purpose. And so when you think about veterans coming back, giving them a mission, giving them a sense of identity, giving them a meaningful project that is purposeful, that helps them ground themselves. And it's the same thing with kids moving from high school to adulthood.
Ben, thanks so much for having us in your venue.
Thanks. Thanks for coming to the venue.
That was Ben Donenberg, founder of the Shakespeare Center of Los Angeles. Its production of Henry IV, starring Tom Hanks, is outdoors on the VA campus in West LA through July 1st. And one note, Hanks will be absent from two performances this weekend. Like a lot of people, he's got a kid who's graduating from college. Coming up, Spotify's popular playlists seem to have a gender imbalance issue. Thank you.
KPCC supporters include HBO presenting Game of Thrones. Summers span decades. Winters can last a lifetime. In the epic season of this colossal hit, the people of Westeros fight for their seat on the Iron Throne. Winter is here, and beyond the Great Wall that protects them, a forgotten evil has returned. Emmy-eligible for Outstanding Drama Series and all other categories.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. It is Thursday, and here at The Frame World Headquarters, that means we're preparing to send out our weekly newsletter. It's a great way to stay current with the show and with headlines from the wide, wide world of culture, arts, and entertainment. You can sign up at theframe.org/newsletter. And now we look at Spotify and its highly influential music playlists. Musicians and labels see these playlists like Rap Caviar or New Music Friday or Rock This as an important, if not essential, part of their promotional plans. But a quick glance through the featured music reveals an uneven playing field. Not all genders and races are equally represented. Spotify has made some efforts to adjust. In March, it released the Smirnoff Equalizer. It's a tool used to measure the number of male and female artists that you listen to. But it made music writer Liz Pelly wonder if Spotify's culpability lay more in the algorithms that it uses to generate new music suggestions. In a recent story for the website The Baffler, Pelly examined Spotify's top playlists for gender bias, and she took time to discuss her findings with me.
I decided to pick out a sampling of some of the 6 most prominent playlists on Spotify. For 4 weeks, every week I downloaded a spreadsheet of every track that was included on those 6 playlists. I looked at the percentage of tracks led by men versus tracks led by women. I didn't find any artists on any of these playlists that identified as a gender other than as a man or a woman. Going into it, I didn't think the numbers would be as grim as they were. So on the big pop playlist, today's top hits, I found 20% of the tracks over the course of these weeks to be led by women. Rap Caviar, 2%, Rock This, 9%, Hot Country, 5.9%. The playlist that had the most representation of women artists out of the ones I looked at was Viva Latino, which had 24% women's tracks on it. And then, you know, when I looked at features and collaborations, those numbers went slightly up. But for example, when all women's contributions were looked at on Rap Caviar, it was still only 8% of the tracks included women at all. And on Hot Country, that number only went up to 7.8%. So they were staggeringly male-dominated, I would say.
And one of the things that I found fascinating about your report is these algorithms are essentially working off of listening histories. And you went into this with a blank slate. You created a new account so that you didn't have a listening history, and still it pointed you to male artist after male artist after male artist. Do I have that right?
Correct. So based on this listening that I did of listening to today's top hits, Rap Caviar, Rock This, Viva Latino, Hot Country, and New Music Friday, and then I also looked at, I listened to Discover Weekly every week, and then I looked at the Discover Weekly suggestions and kept track of the gender bias in those as well, and found it to be the average gender bias of the curated playlists that I listened to was almost exactly reproduced in the algorithmic suggestions that I had given to me every Monday through Discover Weekly.
And what that does, obviously, is it creates a loop that if female artists are not being promoted, that they're not going to get on other playlists, and it just becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I'm wondering if Spotify, in some ways, is following what the labels are doing and mirroring what Grammy voters are doing, and that is favoring men over women. So even if the country is roughly 50-50 men and women, music isn't always the same. How much is Spotify kind of reflecting what's out there?
For sure. And that's one of the main questions that I wanted to think about going into this, because in the piece, I point out that when this whole Smirnoff Equalizer thing happened earlier this year around International Women's Day, which was this sort of woke algorithmic, like branded content partnership that Spotify and Smirnoff did together. But when that came out, it came out with a press release where Spotify and Smirnoff pointed out the fact that at the end of 2017, all of the most streamed tracks on Spotify were all by male artists. There weren't any women artists represented. And then also at the end of last year, there is an article published by Billboard that actually had the headline, "Let's Hear It for the Boys," talking about how male-dominated the pop charts were last year and how at the end of the year, the most popular artists on the charts for their year-end list were all men. And they said in their article that it was the first time since 1984 that their top 10 artists list was all men. So something I was really trying to think about in this piece is, you know, whether this question of whether streaming culture is reflecting a relentlessly male-centric status quo, or if streaming is actually creating this data-driven echo chamber and more masculine pop music culture.
I think you and I can probably agree with a lot of other people that, unlike what the now departing head of the Grammy organization said, women don't need to step up. Other people need to step up. So is Spotify aware of the issue? Have they addressed it? And are there steps that, even if they haven't announced, they might be able to take to try to remedy?
I'm not totally sure in terms of the biggest playlists on the platform, what their strategy is, what the conversations inside look like. What I do know is that they have tried to confront the issue of representation of women artists on their platform by sort of in every genre having these playlists that are titled things like Women of Pop, Women of Rock, Women of Hip Hop, and Women of Classical. And, you know, I think it kind of contributes to people seeing women artists for their gender more than their music, and contributes to this idea that gender is a genre.
A new report says that Spotify might start signing artists exclusively to their service, bypassing traditional record labels. And I'm wondering, in light of your findings, what kind of problems does that create for artists and for Spotify if that's their sole avenue to connect to fans?
I think it's interesting because I feel like for every artist and in all these types of situations, I think artists need to really like think hard about what will work best for them. But I think that there's, you know, a lot lost when we lose on true independent record labels that foster artists and connect dots between communities and provide actual resources and support systems for independent artists. And I think it does, from my perspective, it seems to contribute to the music industry going in this direction where musicians are sort of like independent contractors, like Uber drivers, and they're expected to just sort of like upload their music and be these like independent agents. But as we know, there are so many different protections and support systems that are lost out on.
Liz Pelly, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you for having me.
You can find Liz Pelly's writing at thebaffler.com. And that is it for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow.